today is Achieving Lasting Results in Church Planting. John Clunas spoke about the role of evangelism in church planting. Dick York about a scriptural strategy for church planting. And if you notice the title of my message, it's not to tell you how to plant churches. And the committee was probably pretty wise in selecting a little different topic for me because I'm not a church planter. I've never been involved in the starting of a new assembly. I made some feeble attempts at it once, but they came to nothing. The calling that God gave me before I went to be editor of Interest Magazine was to follow up on the evangelist, to come along 2 or 3 years after the church planter has started the work. We did that in Newfoundland, living in fishing villages in Newfoundland, and then moved to Charlottetown, the capital of Prince Edward Island. After Sven Christensen started a new assembly in the capital city, it was 3 years old, Sven moved to another place, and my wife and I moved over to Prince Edward Island, spent the next 13 years working with that new assembly, developing it, building it up. And so my experience is not in church planting, but in sort of consolidating the results of church planting. Last night I spent a lot of time talking about the biblical principle of the gathering of God's people and the church as a family and so forth. What I'm going to have to say today is not entirely, but primarily observations from my own experience, what I've learned about stabilizing and holding the fruits and the results of the church, and some observations I made in various places over the years that have sort of grown on my mind, and I'll share some of those with you. But I want to begin with a little story about one of our great national parks in this country. I wonder if you've ever visited the cliffside pueblos of Mesa Verde National Park down in southwestern Colorado, tucked into the high vertical cliff walls are huge caverns. And in those caverns, well-preserved remains of large Indian villages. National park tour guides will take you through some of these ruins. And we'll picture ourselves now in one of them that I remember quite well from when my wife visited. High on a cliff, we had to go up a big ladder of logs that the Park Service had conducted. There was nothing like that for the Indians. And they were there for their safety. And they used ropes and tow holes and things like that to get in and out of their dwellings. But now you can climb one of these ladders or sometimes just go in on a trail. And here we are in one of these recessed caves, and the guide is standing us on the little work areas out in front where the people did their cooking and so forth. And he says, "Now you notice that little house over there," he said, "a little square building. It's a two-story building, but you notice there's a difference in the second story. It was put on later. It wasn't there originally. That second story was added in the year 1276, the first year of the long drought." And you scratch your head and you say, "How in the world does this guy know what year the Indians built the second story on that house? He didn't go down to the county offices and look it up in the register of deeds, did he?" No. The walls are of masonry construction, but the ceiling and floors were built with tree trunk beams. Some of those beams are still there. And a scientist can go in and he drills a tiny core out of the beam. And then he has the whole tree ring pattern from that tree. And he takes that tree ring pattern, and you know how it is. In rainy years, the trees grow more than in dry years. You can see that on the branches in your yard. If you ever look at the trees in your yard and notice where the little twigs have gone year by year as the branch goes out. And in a rainy year, you'll get quite a lot of growth, and then maybe have a couple of years with very little extension to the twigs. You can look at that as the buds start coming out this spring. The tree rings are similar. In wet years, moist years, the trees grow more than they do in dry years. And in some of the desert trees in the southwestern part of the United States, the tree ring growths are sensitive reflections of the moisture available. And the scientists lay down these little cores, and they find that they match up. Some other tree, maybe a few years later, will have the same pattern of rings during the years the trees overlap. And they get a distinctive pattern of wide and narrow rings, and they have developed this calendar all the way back to the time of Christ. So they can go in and they can say, that beam that's in that house is a tree that was cut down in the year such and such. So presumably that's the year that building was built. This is a lesson to us, I think, a parable from the Bible principle that In the Bible, rainfall and heavy dew are used as illustrations of the blessing of the Spirit of God and the work of God. God blesses his people. And you remember Isaiah came along to that, or not, Elijah came along to that wicked King Ahab. He said, there's not going to be any dew or any rain now until I say because of your wickedness. God withheld the blessing because of the wickedness of that king and the days in which he was living. In other places, the Bible uses the moisture as a positive symbol. God blesses. And yet, you see, for some reason or other, we have totally failed, most of us have, to expect church growth to result from the blessing of God. Oftentimes, we turn this thing around. And we say that if you're really spiritual and if you're really getting the blessing of God, your church won't grow very much. Now, some church down the road that are very carnal and very worldly and are compromising all the truth, they'll get the crowds. But we're spiritual and we're not going to grow. It's part of the price you have to pay to have the blessing of God and the truth of God. That's not true. The opposite of that is true. That the normal development of spiritual Christianity is that growth results. Maturity in the life and size and numbers in the church. And we ought to expect that. Now, I said last night, the church growth is not a goal, should not be a goal. The goal is to develop biblical New Testament assemblies with spiritual people walking with God, obeying Jesus Christ, and fellowshipping with one another. That's the growth. That's the goal. But when you do that, then growth is the result. The normal result. Growth is normal to a healthy church, just as it is to a healthy tree. And we ought to measure that growth. When I was a little boy, my mother used to line us kids up against one of the doorposts in the upstairs hallway, and she'd put a yardstick over her head and make a pencil mark on the back of the wall, and we'd done Jim, 1934. And then there'd be 1935 and 36, and they kept going up. And you know, if you do that with your children and the numbers, the size doesn't keep going up, if it stops, you take them to a doctor. Something's wrong. Growth is normal in a healthy child, in a healthy tree, and in a healthy church. Acts 2:42. Would you turn to that with me, please? That's a favorite text of brethren preachers, even if it is a four-point outline. There's nothing wrong with four-point outlines. They just don't preach quite as easily as three-point outlines do. But nevertheless, Acts 2:42 is a very commonly used text in brethren assemblies, and I've preached it many times. They continued steadfastly in the apostles' doctrine, fellowship, breaking of bread, and prayers. Four characteristics of a New Testament church. And one day I got looking to this passage, and I looked at verse 41, and it said, well, what about the characteristic in verse 41? Then those who gladly received his word were baptized, and that day about 3,000 souls were added. Why not say that there are 5 points in this sermon, and that church growth is one of the characteristics of a New Testament church? And I began to study the Bible, and I found that's the book of Acts, and that's exactly what you find in the book of Acts. The breaking of bread, the apostles' doctrine, fellowship, prayer, certainly those are characteristics of a New Testament church, but so is growth. And they weren't afraid to measure it. They weren't afraid to say 3,000 people were added. And down in verse 47, the Lord added to the church daily those who were being saved. They were getting blessing, people were being converted, and the church was growing. Let's trace this on in a few verses here. Acts 4, verse 4. Acts chapter 4, verse 4. Many of those who heard the word believed, and the number of the men came to be about 5,000. There's the number again. They counted. They knew how many they had. There was no apology for that in the book of Acts. Acts chapter 5, verse 14. And believers were increasingly added to the Lord, multitudes of both men and women. The author of the book of Acts liked mathematical terms. He's been using the term for addition. Now in our next passage, he shifts to multiplication. Acts chapter 6, verse 1. The number of the disciples was multiplying. Verse 7. The word of God spread, and the number of the disciples multiplied greatly in Jerusalem. Acts chapter 9, verse 31. Then the churches throughout all Judea, Galilee, and Samaria had peace and were edified. And walking in the fear of the Lord and in the comfort of the Holy Spirit, they were multiplied. The ministry of the Holy Spirit is brought in there in that passage. And so it is also in Acts 11:24. Acts 11:24. Barnabas was a good man, full of the Holy Spirit and of faith, and a great many people were added to the Lord. Some churches grow by becoming larger. Others grow by pushing their people out into evangelism and the planting of new churches, or onto the mission field. The next two passages illustrate geographical growth and the steadily increasing number of local churches. Chapter 13, verse 49. The word of the Lord was being spread throughout all the region. Acts chapter 16, verse 5. Acts chapter 16, verse 5. So the churches were strengthened in the faith and increased in number daily. Is it possible to read this series of passages without concluding that growth is indeed a characteristic of a New Testament church? And if the church is not growing, is it not time we asked ourselves what is wrong? Isn't something wrong if we're not growing? Can we call ourselves New Testament churches if we are not experiencing growth? Or can we only say that we're partially New Testament churches? In view of this New Testament emphasis on growth, it seems to me that we have to include that as one of the characteristics or principles of the New Testament church. Now, just a word of caution. I'm not saying that numerical growth is a proof of spirituality. We know that false religions sometimes grow very rapidly. We know that carnal preachers can draw huge crowds. We know that cancer is a form of growth. We know that the mustard seed grows into a huge bush where worldly birds find shelter, and that's from the parables of the Lord Jesus. So we cannot say growth is a proof of spirituality. That is, you can't say, my assembly is growing, and therefore that proves that my assembly is spiritual, because carnal churches can also grow. I think, though, that what we can say is that growth is a measure of spirituality. It's an evidence. That is, the lack of growth is significant if a church is concerned to be a spiritual, biblical church. Always use the lack of growth as a reason for checking up on your behavior and your methods and your spiritual vitality. Now, that's the first thing that I want to say in this message, that growth is normal to a Christian church. And the second thing that I want to say is that the leveling off of growth is also normal. That is, there is a tendency for attendance in a church to plateau, to reach a certain point and then not to stop growing and to stay there at that point and not to go on any farther. Churches tend to grow to a certain size and then level off. And I think the first place I observed that was during my 13 years in Charlottetown. When my wife and I moved there in 1958 from Newfoundland, it was a small work. When the Sunday school classes were dismissed, I'd go back and there'd be people in the last two rows, and I'd get the fourth row from the back, and I'd put one foot up on the pew and rest my Bible on my knee and teach the adult Bible class, the morning preaching service. That was all that was left after the rest of our adults went out to teach the children in the classes. After we'd been there a few years, we had an auditorium this size pretty well filled. But also after we'd been there a while, I noticed that we stopped growing. We leveled off. Maybe it was because my time was done there, maybe not. Maybe it was for other reasons. But I noticed that the growth seemed to come to a halt. Since I moved to Wheaton in 1971 and did a lot of traveling among assemblies, I began to notice the same pattern. And I preached in small assemblies through these last 14 years that are the same size now as they were when I first went there 13, 14 years ago. I preached in some very healthy, very large assemblies down in North Carolina, 400 or 500 people in the main auditorium for the Sunday morning preaching service. And if you went back to those churches today, some of them still have the 400 or 500. They have stopped growing. Not all of them, of course. But even the larger assemblies seem to level off at a certain point. And what causes that? What brings that about, that plateauing feature of church attendance? The second thing that I began to notice as I was thinking about these things is whenever there was a significant loss of membership, the church started growing again. I've observed that in a lot of places, and I've asked other people about it and said, what's your experience on this line, and found out the same thing. In Wheaton, Bethany Chapel, where we are in Wheaton, several years ago, a number of families moved away in one summer. We had a very devastating loss of families, but we started growing again. We'd had a stable attendance, a stable size, and now we lost these families, and within 6 months we were back to the size we were before. And then it leveled off. A year ago, three or four families got discontented with the assembly and pulled out and left it. That was a heavy loss all at once. But it wasn't 3 or 4 or 5 months before we were right back to the size where we were before. When a significant loss of membership occurs, the growth process begins immediately. And this occurs sometimes even in traumatic situations of a church split. We hear people saying, the Lord will never bless that group. They did wrong, and the Lord will never bless them. And he does. I've thought about this a lot. I remember one time when I was a college student working with a couple of evangelistic societies in Newark, New Jersey, and sitting in the office of one of those societies and listening to the old people there talking about whatever had caused these two organizations to split up with each other years before, before I came on the scene at any rate, some falling out, some fight or something, and hearing one of the women who was the leader in one of those organizations saying, the Lord will never bless them until they right that wrong, until they confess their sin, until they straighten it out. Well, I was going to Saturday night rallies with that other group. They were having Saturday night youth rallies, and I knew the Lord was blessing them. And again, I've heard people saying this about churches, and when there's a church split, you know, the Lord can't bless them unless they confess that wrong and make that right. Yet somehow it seems that he does. And that that's not to say the Lord condones the wrong, but, you know, we say this almost theoretical, that if there's something wrong in your moral life, something not confessed, not dealt with, if you haven't righted the wrong, God can't bless and you can't grow. And then we look around and we see that it happens anyway. Maybe it's the overruling grace of God. But if you have a ruckus in your congregation and a third of the people leave and walk out and go somewhere else, and you've had a stable attendance for years, you may all of a sudden discover that you start growing again. New people start coming in, filling in the cracks, and before long you're back to the size where you were before. Now, of course, there are times when a church fight can be so devastating that the work never recovers. I recognize that this is not always the case. It certainly is the case sometimes. When there's a church split, you often end up with two groups that were the size of the original group. Another type of loss occurs when a church deliberately decides to hive off, to start a new congregation, a new assembly somewhere. And people are very hesitant to do that. It's a hard decision to make. It seems very threatening. And people say when the conversation comes up, we can't really afford this. We're not very strong. We can't afford to give these people up. And you know, it's such a struggle now to keep the work going that if we started a new place, that it would devastate us. Instead, what seems to happen is that when a group of people leave, especially if it's carefully done, planned carefully, it gives an opportunity for other people who have been there all the time and never been very active to step into roles of leadership. There's a gap, there's a need, and people who have never taken part before all of a sudden begin to move forward and begin to do something. So that you soon get more people involved than you had involved before. A hive off that is not carefully planned, of course, could take away all the younger families. All the younger families could pull out and go into a new community and leave all the older people, and that's not very productive. That could be quite devastating. So a hive off should be given some planning so that there's a proportionate number of older and younger ones, of people with ability and so forth. But, you know, it's one of the things that ought to be considered. You start looking at your congregation and looking at your attendance and start measuring it and saying, you know, we're the same size now as we were 5 years ago. We're not growing at all. Maybe the thing the Lord wants you to do is start a new work. Hive off. Move on somewhere else and begin something new. That term hive off comes from the bees. A typical colony of honeybees consists of a queen and many thousands of worker bees and a few hundred drones. And when the hive becomes overcrowded, a large swarm of bees will leave it and establish a new colony with a new queen. And that's called hiving off. And sometimes that's God's will for a church. And certainly when attendance is leveled off, that's the time to consider it. No, that's not natural for us, you know. Mostly we would say when we're not growing, this is no time to consider hiving off. But if we're really growing, then that's the time to consider it. I think probably the reverse is true. I think I would be inclined to say to a church that is really growing, no, this is not the time to hive off. You might kill that growth pattern. You might devastate it. Keep growing. You're growing now. Don't split up the work. But if you're not growing, maybe that's the time to consider. Now, to some extent, what I'm saying is this opinion, and you may have a different feeling about it. But if I can provoke you to think about these things, to watch these processes, to look at them and give some thought to them, that will be constructive, and you may come to agree with the observations that I've reached in this matter. Churches tend to grow to a certain size and then level off. Second, when a significant loss occurs, growth resumes. And then, thirdly, when a loss occurs and growth resumes again, that growth is independent of any effort to try to get the church to grow. Now, I may get in trouble with my friend John Clunas here by saying that, but what I'm saying is you don't need to have gospel campaigns. You don't need to canvass the whole neighborhood in order to get growth. I'm not saying you shouldn't do those things. Great. And I'm not contradicting the efforts of those who would get out in evangelism and reach the neighborhood. I'm all for that. I believe in that. And don't misunderstand me. I'm not contradicting that. But what I'm saying is that even if you don't do those things, growth will occur. When we had those losses in Bethany Chapel, we didn't make any effort, any special effort to rebuild the attendance. But we started growing again. And I think the reason for this goes back to my original principles, that growth is normal to a spiritual Christian church, even if you don't try. When I was a little kid, I didn't try to grow. And my mother measured my height and put the little marks on the wall. If we hadn't sold that house and moved away, I guess they'd still be there. Maybe they are, for all I know. But growth is normal without effort. So much the better if you make the effort and reach out to the lost. I guess I came to this understanding when we were in Charlottetown, and I realized that I didn't have any particular soul-winning gift. I'm not a soul winner. I'm not an evangelist. And yet we were experiencing some growth. And I began to say to myself, here we are in this congregation, and we've got some wonderful Christians. And they've got young people, they've got grade schoolers, and they've got high school kids, and I'm not a gifted evangelist. And if I can shape and structure this assembly in such a way that our young people don't rebel and stay with the assembly, we will grow if we never reach another family in the community. If we never touch another outsider, the children that are coming along in our families, if we can hold them, we'll have growth. We'll be a growing church. It's a real pleasure for me to go back to Prince Edward Island today after being away from there for 15 years, having been there for 13 before that, and to sit down in a breaking of bread meeting and look at some of the folks that are a little older than my wife and I, in their 60s, 70s maybe. So, then look across the room and there see their children that were teenagers when we were there. Maybe I baptized them, some of them, married some of them, and then look a little farther along and see the children of those teenagers. They're not teenagers anymore, Their children are teenagers. Third generation up in their teens in fellowship and breaking bread, seeing three generations at the Lord's table, and then beside that the little children coming along in those new families. It's an exciting thing to see the blessing of having sort of guided and shaped a work in which the young people don't get lost to the work. Now, Prince Edward Island has a problem that many areas have, that in order to get jobs, a lot of the young people go to Toronto and Montreal and places like that. But a lot of them stay there. And your work can grow just through the normal fact that families have more children, you know, and there's an expansion there. Growth is natural to a Christian church. And if we have a real walk with the Lord and a real spirituality, people will be attracted. You know, there's hardly a church, hardly an assembly where new people don't come in occasionally. Look around on Sunday morning as the weeks go by. Unless you're in a very remote rural community, the chances are there are people coming in somehow or other, wherever they come from, I don't know. Mostly what happens is that they don't stay. You know, they come and they look and they don't stay, but sometimes some of them will stay. And this plateau idea means that that as people move away and as there become, shall I say, vacancies in the appropriate level of the assembly, then people will stay and will continue. And you fill in the ranks, and even without any particular effort, you can experience growth. Now, when you watch that, when you see that happen in your congregation, when you see the fact that you're the same size as you were 5 years ago, however, several families have moved away in those 5 years, and where did you get the new families? Well, that's growth, isn't it? At least it's replacement growth. And that's encouraging to us. Now, when we face this plateau situation, there's a couple of choices we can make. And one of those choices is to hive off. But the other one is to take corrective action. To say to ourselves, why have we leveled off at a certain point? If it is true that growth is normal, why have we stopped growing? What is the matter? Is there some hindrance? Is there something that causes us to level off at this size? And if so, is there something we can do about it? Can we remove the hindrance? Can we take it out of the way? Well, I guess that our tendency when a question is asked like that is to say, well, it's a spiritual problem. If you want to grow, you've got to read the Bible more. You've got to really have more Bible study. We've got to be more intense in our Bible study, or we've got to start praying more. The normal reaction on most of our parts is that if we're not growing, there's a spiritual problem. And I think that's probably not true. It may be true in some cases. But I think most of the time, this plateauing effect comes about not for spiritual reasons at all. And your assembly may be much more spiritual or just as spiritual as some church down the road that's growing quite well. Nelson Annan discusses this, and we've run a long series of articles, 9 articles by Nelson Annan, who is now in Florida, called Planning for Growth. And I see that Israel Martin has photocopied this series and has them on the table back there, and he's selling them for $1, which is strictly the photocopying charge cost to him. I tried to get a little royalty out of him, but since they came from Interest Magazine, but without success. Oddly enough, this series was from 2 messages that Nelson Annan gave in Chicago a year ago when we had a combined meeting with Letters of Interest and the Chicago Missionary Study class, and he had 2 sermons, and I recorded them and then broke them up into small parts and gave each part a title, wrote in some transitional paragraph, and made a whole series of articles out of them. And you know, because he had given us so much material in such a short time, I think the effect is that every single one of these short articles has the same impact as the original messages had all together, because you can only digest so much at a time. And he's very helpful in this area of this matter of how do you get churches to grow and why aren't you growing. And he talks about the tendency that we have to say, this is in the article, the second article called Mistaken Perspective, the tendency to say, well, if we were only more spiritual, we'd start to grow. He says, I've been in a lot of these growing churches. He said, I'm not afraid to compare your elders with their elders and the level of Bible knowledge in your assembly with the level of Bible knowledge in theirs, and oftentimes you may be way ahead of them. That's not the reason. It's not lack of prayer either. Now, sometimes it may be, you know, there may be real spiritual reasons involved, but it's not necessarily the case. And I say this in order to be an encouragement to you. So, you know, the tendency is you want to talk about grow. What shall we do in order that we may grow? That's the question you're likely to ask yourself. If you sit down, the elders sit down, or the assembly sits down and say, let's talk about this, and let's decide what we need to do in order to grow like a New Testament church should grow. And I'm saying you don't ask that question. If you ask that question, you'll say, well, we need to canvass the neighborhood, we need to send out tracts, we need to go out door to door, we need to hold street meetings, and you'll look for things you can do. And I'm saying don't ask that question. Instead, ask the question, what shall we don't? What are we doing wrong? What can we correct? How can we remove the hindrances? If we don't have to do anything to grow, if we'll grow naturally, what are we doing that's stopping growth? What's preventing it? Take a look at that. You can answer the other question, too, about what shall we do. But you can do all kinds of evangelistic efforts. If your assembly has reached a plateau point and you start going out with the gospel and you start winning souls, you may find that 5 years down the road you're no bigger than you were before. Have you seen that? You all know churches that are always getting people baptized, always getting converts, and they're no bigger now than they were 20 years ago. People are going out the back door as fast as they come in the front door. They're losing them. They're not holding them. They're not growing. So we not only want to reach out to the lost, but we want to deal with the factors that inhibit growth and try to change them so that the normal growing process will resume again. And I'd like to suggest what some of these hindrances are and maybe divide them up into three different categories. Three things you want to look at to break out of the plateau. Physical hindrances, organizational hindrances, and leadership hindrances. There may be more. I'm lumping some things together here. For instance, take the matter of physical hindrances. The assembly I'm in, Bethany Chapel, somewhere between 150, 200 people, we're not growing. We're not going to grow. For one thing, perhaps one of the main reasons is our parking lot is too small. Now, that's not a very spiritual reason, is it? But it's surprising how things like that can affect growth. People have to park over there in the supermarket, catty corner across the road, and there's big signs there about your car going to be towed away if you park there and all that, you know. People don't like to walk very far in these days. And if you have a very limited parking lot, that may cause your work to plateau. It may not be the only reason, but it can be a very basic factor. We're bound into a very tiny little corner property. We've talked about all kinds of things. We have only three Sunday school rooms, I think, in our building. We're using them doubled up. We have a breaking of bread service, then we have an adult Bible class and children's classes, and then we have a preaching service, three services on Sunday morning. We've split up our Sunday school so that those three rooms, plus a few other places, get used twice. That is, we'll have the children at the 10 o'clock hour and the junior high and high school kids in the rooms at the 11 o'clock hour. And we double-deck our rooms like that. We used to rent an apartment in one of the apartments across the way. That'd get pretty expensive. So this double-decking, double use of the rooms is helpful. But we've talked about building a Sunday school extension out over the parking lot. We didn't talk very much about it because we knew the city fathers would never approve it. But it's a problem to us. Physical size, the size of your auditorium. And church growth statistics and people who have studied these things and done surveys have pretty well determined that when your auditorium is 80% full, you know, something like we have here today, maybe there's room for a few more, but generally speaking, when you're 80% full, you're going to stop growing at that point. Or it can have that effect. It's time to think about enlarging your auditorium or double-decking your preaching services. That people aren't comfortable if an auditorium is too full, as a general thing. Now, it's always good to have some occasions when you have a packed-out crowd. You have to put chairs down the aisles and everything else like that. That's always good for the work, because people can see that you can fill the place up. But in the long run, perhaps 80% full auditorium is a sort of a limiting factor. You can enlarge the work, and maybe, or you can move. Sometimes the community that you're in limits the size of the work. There are some physical things like that. Then there's also some organizational hindrances to growth. Slipshod ways of doing things, I believe, are one of the main factors that tend to keep brethren assemblies small. You see, we're not strong in organization. Part of that grows out of our biblical principles of wanting the Holy Spirit to lead and wanting to follow the Lord. And we tend to shy away from organization perhaps too much. And so you find services being conducted in a very unorganized way. You come in 5 minutes before the service is supposed to start, maybe 2 minutes before, and you see that the song leader is sitting down in the front row quick picking out the hymns to start the service. People are chatting, and they may not even have come in until after the thing begins, and the ushering is rather slipshod. Watch the announcements. One of the quickest way to see a sort of a disorganized service is to watch the way the announcements are conducted. They're long and they're draggy. Somebody can't seem to condense them at all. He ambles on. They spend more time on announcements than they do in the sermon in some places. And people are coming up during the announcement period and handing little notes to the guys making the announcement. We have this problem in Prince Edward Island, and I'm telling you, I had a hard job not offending people. Say, I don't want you to bring me announcements while I'm making the announcements. You can't remember ahead of time, we're not going to make that announcement. But then, you know, and somebody will put up their hand while you're making this. Oh, don't forget to announce the young people today. Now, what do you think the effect of that is on a visitor who's from the Episcopalian Church? This is a nice group. Oh, they're friendly people here. But, you know, they're really not a church. It's a nice group, sort of like a social club or something. And a slipshod way of doing things is a sign that you need some attention to your work. I have a little slogan. I say, don't announce the announcements. Only announce things that have to be announced. Don't say, for instance, we will now have a special music by a girls trio. Our people can count. And in our circles, you can still tell the boys from the girls. So tell your girls trio and tell your pianist that after we sing hymn number 42, then the girls are going to sing at that point. And tell them, and then don't stand up and say, we're not going to have a girls' trio. Let them walk up and sing their song and sit down. Don't announce things that are only for the benefit of the person on the platform. Brother so-and-so will now lead us in prayer. You don't need to tell the congregation that. You can tell him privately. Now, after I make the announcement, you lead in prayer, all right? Stand up and lead in prayer. Don't announce things that don't have to be announced. That's one way of shutting down your announcement time. And making the service seem to be more professional. Operate more smoothly. And don't announce the announcement. The song leader says, we will now have the announcement. Don't say that. Let the guy come up and make the announcement. And only introduce your speaker once. I have counted sometimes. I sat on a platform to preach, and I've counted my name being announced 5 times in the opening prayer. Lord, we're glad to have Brother Starr here today, and he'll be speaking later, and Lord bless him. And then when the announcements come, now Brother Starr's with us today. That's twice. And then the song leader gets up, and now before Brother Starr speaks, we're going to sing hymn number so-and-so. And we sing it, we all sit up. And now Brother Starr will speak to us. That's only 4 times. I've gotten 5 sometimes. By that time, I think the Spirit of God must be driven out of the place because he's not interested in glorifying Brother Starr. You know? Use the announcement period to say who your speaker is for the day. Tell about him. Don't tell about him just before he speaks. If you can avoid that, sometimes you have to, but that takes away from the spirituality of the meeting. The hymns lead up to the message and prepare the hearts of the people. So if you want to tell all about your speaker and who he is, and it's a good thing to do that during the announcement period. You can say during that period also, special music today is being provided by our young ladies trio from this assembly. And you don't need to say that just before they sing, and then there's a better chance that the Spirit of God can really take that and minister to the lives of people. Now, Nelson Annan, he gets on this subject of slipshod activities, and this is in his part 4 of this article. Through visitors' eyes. Try to step back and look with the eyes of a visitor as you drive up on Sunday morning. as you come up to your own assemblies, try to see it through the eyes of the visitor. Ask yourself whether there is convenient parking. Look at the building. Ask yourself how it appears. Look at the sign out front. What does it say? Does the fact that it hasn't been painted in 10 years say to visitors, hey, we take our assembly pretty much for granted. We don't expect anybody to be attracted, so we don't paint anything on the outside. We only paint the inside where the insiders are. As you come inside, is anybody standing at the door and welcoming visitors and making sure they find a place to sit? Or directing parents with small children to the nursery? And what are the nursery facilities like? What's the bulletin like? Does it say, hey, we don't care what goes on here, just slap it together because somebody always wants it done this way? What is the chairman like? Does he make people relax and feel glad they are present? Do people feel that he's in control and the service is well planned? As the service begins, ask yourself whether a visitor would really be impressed by what goes on in the first 15 minutes. Studies show that most people have decided within 15 minutes of entering the building whether or not they are going to come back to that church. That's very humbling to a preacher like myself, to know that it doesn't really depend on me whether that visitor stays. They made up their mind before I ever get up there to speak. But you know, those are real factors that we tend to not to be able to look at our work and see what's going on here. Informality. Levels of informality. For how formal are your services? How formal should they be? That may depend a little bit on the community. If people you're trying to reach come from very liturgical churches where there's a great reverence and awe in the meetings, you may have to be careful about being a little bit too informal. Depends on how conservative the community is. When I went down to North Carolina, be in that place where there's 400 people and the chairman would say, now who's new here today? Who's never been here before? Stand up. What's your name? And this is North Carolina. That's all right in North Carolina. The usher would give them a packet, you know. I said to myself, if we ever did that in Charlottetown, we'd drive away every visitor because the Prince Edward Island people are more conservative. They're not like that. They wouldn't like that. Test people. Don't go up to a stranger and say, hello, what's your name? Don't do that. Think of yourself. Supposing you went into a Jehovah's Witness church and you want to see what it was like. And in the middle of the service, the guy gets up and, oh, brother so-and-so from the Bible chapel. Glad to have... Oh, you'd be embarrassed. You're going to hide in the back row, see, because you're a little uncertain there. You go up to a stranger and you say, hello, my name is Jim Stark. And then you listen to see whether he tells you his name or not. If he just says, I'm glad to meet you, he hasn't given you his name, he probably wants a little anonymity, don't embarrass him. Introduce him to some other people, but without his name. If he doesn't express it, you know, just say, here's Brother Sozo, he's one of our elders, and we're glad to have you here today, you know, and don't press him. If on the other hand he comes, I'm so-and-so, he's glad to have his name known, then use his name, you see, but let him give you the signal as to whether he wants to hide or whether he wants to be known. And I think those things are important, this whole matter of how formal or informal services should be. And then sometimes assemblies are hindered from growing because the level of ministry in the assembly is very inadequate. The preaching is poor. The Bible teaching is poor. Everybody takes his turn, and it doesn't work very well that way. And we need to be willing to invest money in the ministry of the word, and by that I mean maybe some of the elders. An elder who's a good preacher ought to be encouraged to give up part of his employment and give more time to preaching and studying. Or maybe we need to bring in more visiting preachers or do something to get the quality of the preaching up. That can be very devastating to a work when the preaching is very inadequate. People don't want to bring anybody because they don't know what's going to happen. They might get a good sermon one week and a disaster the next, so they don't know what to expect. And then I think I better skip a couple points here. I've run out of time. Let me just say about this third area. Leadership. Leadership levels. I don't want to say hindrances so much as levels. But a work will grow to a point where the leaders of the work have reached their capacity, where they're no longer capable of leading more people. You see this in business, too. You see a man who starts a little hardware store and he's going great guns. Up to a certain point, and then he doesn't have the ability really to run a whole chain of hardware stores, but he's making money on the first one, so he starts another one or two, and pretty soon he's bankrupt because he couldn't keep the whole thing under control. He had gotten beyond his ability. Businesses grow to a certain size. If you've got a Lee Iacocca, you can run a pretty big corporation. But most of us, if we were running our own business, would tend to have it a little smaller than that because we're not capable of that administrative level. And so leadership is a factor in the growth of a work. And when you get to that leveling off place, then the elders and leaders have got to say to themselves, what can we do? Can we enlarge the leadership? Now, shall we bring in more elders and make our leadership bigger? Then new men can contribute to, and our ability to lead will be enlarged.